listening to West Virginia Week, a regular podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting that looks back at the major stories of the week. We're wrapping up our coverage of the West Virginia legislative session. Saturday, March 9th is the final day state lawmakers can consider bills during this regular session. We bring you conversations with members of the House of Delegates and Senate who look back at the last 60 days and ahead. We also bring you conversations from our new student reporter program, and we hear from our State House reporters who share what they've been watching this session. Finally, we'll hear from a professor who helps us understand our vaccination laws here in West Virginia. I'm your host this week, Liz McCormick. Let's jump right in with a few short news stories. Governor Jim Justice has extended the legislative session to address the state's budget. Chris Schultz has more.
The governor issued a proclamation Thursday extending the legislature's regular session by one day to Sunday, March 10th. The proclamation states that, quote, no matters other than the budget bill shall be considered during this extension of the regular session. An extension is required by the state constitution if a budget bill hasn't been completed 3 days before the end of the session. A potential clawback of federal money due to education spending was announced last week that required changes to appropriations as recently as Tuesday. Extending session to address the budget was the norm for many years, but recently legislative leadership has prided itself on completing the budget within the 60-day session. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
A potential strike at 38 Kroger stores appears to have been averted. Eric Douglas has the story.
Kroger and the United Food Commercial Workers Local 400 Union reached a fully recommended tentative agreement on a new contract Thursday. Just last week, the union had voted to authorize the strike, but returned to the bargaining table. It had planned informational pickets starting March 11th. The strike would have affected 3,000 employees in 38 stores in West Virginia, Kentucky, and Ohio. The union will hold a ratification vote for bargaining unit members next week. Kroger is the nation's largest unionized grocery retailer. The two sides used a federal mediator to reach the agreement. It raises starting wages to $13 per hour, and provides wage increases up to $2.50 per hour for department leaders and top-rate associates over the life of the contract. It also includes a premium increase for all night shift work. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Douglas in Charleston.
Spouses can now be charged with marital sexual abuse against their partners after a bill to close the loophole in the law passed both chambers Friday. Emily Rice has more.
Senate Bill 190 eliminates marriage as a defense for first and third degree sexual assault in West Virginia. The bill requires that there was physical force that overcame earnest resistance. Previously, the state's sexual offense statute that defined marriage allowed exemptions for certain kinds of assault when people are married or living together as husband and wife, regardless of legal status of their relationship. The bill passed the Senate on February 26th and the House on Friday by a vote of 99 yeas and one delegate absent. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Rice in Charleston.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency has sent some residents letters about aid for floods last year. Jack Walker has more.
Last summer, flash floods swept southern and central West Virginia, damaging homes and businesses across multiple counties. On January 30, President Joe Biden officially declared the event a major disaster, opening the region to more than $1 million in federal aid. FEMA has encouraged individuals affected by the flooding to file insurance claims immediately. For residents who have already submitted their applications, letters from FEMA regarding next steps should have already come or soon be on their way. The letters will indicate if residents need to submit supplemental information to complete their claim. For more information on the disaster recovery efforts and how to file a federal aid claim, visit our website at wvpublic.org. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jack Walker in Shepherdstown.
A state Senate committee heard new details Wednesday about how the Pleasance Power Station will be converted from coal to hydrogen. Curtis Tate has the story.
The Pleasance Power Station is a 1,300-megawatt power plant along the Ohio River north of Parkersburg. Its coal-fired boilers went cold in June when its then-owner, Energy Harbor, shut them down. But state lawmakers, including Senator Donna Boley, a Pleasance County Republican, fought to save the plant from closure. Not long after the plant went idle, a California company called Omnis Technology stepped in. Omnis reactivated the plant. Its ultimate goal, though, is to produce graphite on the site and use the hydrogen byproduct to generate electricity. Burning hydrogen emits no carbon dioxide. However, the source of that hydrogen at Pleasance will still be coal. Steve Winberg, the former Assistant Secretary of Fossil Energy in the Trump administration, explained to the Senate Energy, Industry, and Mining Committee how the process would work.
Their goal is to convert Pleasance from coal to 100% hydrogen and then make the hydrogen from the coal. So at a minimum, we'll see the same amount of coal going to Pleasance, but it will be converted to hydrogen, and then the hydrogen will be burned in the boiler.
Winberg explained to the committee that the technology is emerging. It requires heating the coal to 3,000 degrees Celsius. The bar the process has to clear is producing hydrogen that's cheaper than natural gas.
Proof is in the pudding. We'll see if they're able to get it to work at 3,000 degrees, but if they do, it's a pretty intriguing technology.
Omnis is investing $800 million into the facility. If successful, it will need 600 workers to operate in addition to the 160 who run the current plant. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
You're listening to West Virginia Week, and now some of our top feature stories from the past week. This week on our program, The Legislature Today, we decided to check in with party leaders in the House and Senate to see how they feel about the session and whether the last 60 days met their priorities. Randy Yowie spoke with Delegate Mike Pushkin, a Democrat from Kanawha County. We should note, West Virginia Public Broadcasting invited Republican House leaders to join the discussion, but none were available at the time of this interview.
We wanted to talk to members of both on the House side, the Democratic and Republican Party, to see how they feel about some of these lightning rod issue bills. And with me right now is Delegate Mike Pushkin, a Democrat from Kanawha County, also the chair of the West Virginia Democratic Party. Thanks for being here. We hope to have Marty Gearhart with us, Delegate Marty Gearhart from Mercer County, who is the majority whip. He can't be here right now because he's in the middle of a committee talking heavily about the unemployment bill, which basically lowers the amount of unemployment safety net over time, and it has some clients do more searching for jobs. I think those are two of the highlights, Delegate. What are your thoughts on this unemployment bill?
I would much rather the majority whip, Delegate Gearhart, to be down here with us talking than up there working on what he's working on, because I don't think it's a good idea, and I think it's going to hurt a lot of West Virginians. At this time, it's not the right time to be talking about cutting unemployment benefits, and we're hearing about layoffs and job loss in the Northern Panhandle at Cleveland Cliffs at their facility, and also more recently at Allegheny Wood Products. You know, we're getting this really bad news about job layoffs and job loss, and the Republicans are adding insult to injury by up there working on cutting unemployment benefits when we know that the fund right now is solvent. Unemployment's the fund's doing fine right now in West Virginia. There's no reason for this bill at this time. So I'd much rather Delegate Gearhart be down here with us than up there.
I guess I could be a bad idea. I could be a devil's advocate on one part of it, because I remember interviewing Scott Adkins, the director of Workforce West Virginia, talking about people that weren't really looking for unemployment the way they should. Not going out every 2 weeks for four or five interviews like they should to earn their unemployment, but sometimes just coming back with one or two. So they're asking them to do more. Does that sound fair?
Like right now across the country, unemployment's at an all-time low. It has been for quite some time. And there is work out there. I think that this is the wrong time for this particular bill. And he said that, you know, if we had this upcoming recession and there was more of a demand put on it, then there could be a problem. We haven't seen anything like that really in like 40 years. I don't think we're in danger of that. The fund is solvent, and it's the wrong time to be talking about kicking people off when we're getting all sorts of bad news about job loss in this state.
Well, I know that they've been up hashing this one out for quite a while, so there's some contention there. We'll see what happens. The bill about arming teachers, if you will, letting teachers be school protection officers. They can carry a concealed weapon, a stun gun, or a taser. There was an amendment to this bill, I thought, that twisted a little bit the initial reasoning for it when it came to counties being to opt in or opt out. Your thoughts?
First of all, West Virginia has a whole lot of pressing issues. We just talked about some of the job loss in the northern part of the state. We have a foster care crisis. We're in a child care desert. People can't get back to work because they're unable to find care for their children. We have not enough teachers in the classroom. We don't have enough correctional officers in our jails and prisons. Yet what the Republican supermajority wants to focus on are bills like arming teachers. And we're not hearing a huge public outcry from people who want to, calling for this bill. We definitely didn't hear from it from the teachers. I think it's a very misguided bill. The amendment, you're right, made it much worse. It says that a county board shall grant this to any teacher that goes through the minimal training that's required of this. So they don't get to, so a student could be, a teacher could be first day on the job and sign up for this training, and all of a sudden they're able to carry a gun into the classroom.
The original bill said that counties could opt in or opt out, school boards of education.
It allowed the teachers that option if they go through the training. This said the county board has no choice. If the teacher asked for it, they have, no matter how long they've been a teacher. And one part that's very troubling about it, the parents have absolutely no knowledge of which teachers are going to be carrying and which teachers are going to have guns around their children.
Yeah, that bill. Now that bill is still in committee. A lot of these bills, these hot button bills, are still in committee.
Out of the House, and it's over in a Senate committee.
Right.
And hopefully, they have more sense than the House did, but I wouldn't bet on it.
Another one that's hotly contested are these school vaccine exemptions.
Yeah.
I mean, it started out where let's exempt some of the students that are in virtual classes, which I think even a lot of people thought made some sense. There was some sense to that because those people weren't involved with other students. But then amendments added other schools, micro schools and all the other school choice schools. And then a third amendment added anybody that wanted a religious exemption.
Yeah.
And I know that the head of the Kanawha County Health Department said you're either anti-vaccine or pro-disease. I mean, that was a pretty strong statement.
Yeah. I'm glad that at least one public health official had the courage to speak out. I'm still waiting to hear from our state officials and from our universities to speak up, because I know how they feel about it, same way I feel about it. We're moving backwards here. One thing West Virginia has done right over the years is our rules and our laws regarding childhood vaccines. And that's why you haven't heard of measles outbreaks happening here in West Virginia. Hear about it in neighboring states. And that's why we've been able to eradicate so many diseases that crippled our society for years.
That was Delegate Mike Pushkin speaking with Randy Yowie about the end of the 2024 regular legislative session. Our reporter covering the state Senate, Brianna Heaney, sat down to speak with Senate Minority Leader Mike Wolfel, a Democrat from Cabell County, and Mike Oliverio, a Republican from Monongalia County, to discuss where things stand for them and how it compares to what they plan to do at the beginning of the session.
Today, I am sitting here with Senator Wolfel, a Democrat from Cabell County, and Senator Oliverio, a Republican from Monongalia County. And we're going to talk about the last 59 days. All right, so let's start off with legislative priorities. At the very beginning, child care was kind of a bipartisan legislative priority. At this point, a lot of those bills, the majority of those bills, have not made it to the deadline. What happened? Let's start with you.
You know, I'm the fellow for West Virginia with the Hunt Institute. And the Hunt Institute's an educational nonprofit. And one of the big priorities of the Hunt Institute is early child care programs, the 0-3, 0-4 age commitments. And I'd like to see us do more in that area. I'm not going to give up on it. I'm going to continue to work on that in the years ahead. But I think the state in the United States that can figure out how to best deliver early child care will be the state that will leapfrog ahead of many others.
Mm, that's an interesting point.
Well, I had three bills that were introduced day one for child care tax credits. And the governor echoed that sentiment at the State of the State. And we got not one bill moved an inch. So I'm very disappointed about that. I've repeatedly asked leadership about in the Senate about why we aren't moving, helping working West Virginians. It's not a handout. It's a reimbursement of money they pay out so that they can go to work and expand our workforce. Child poverty is 25% and rising in West Virginia. So people need to work. kids need to have working parents. And I think because of our tax cuts last year, there's no money to even start a conversation with child care tax credits.
I think it's interesting, not only do we have a Democrat and Republican, but we also have two people from the two perspective committees, Finance Committee and Judiciary Committee. Talk to me about what happened to these bills. Why didn't they make it to the finish line?
You know, I think one of the big challenges we had this year in putting the budget together, a roughly $5 billion budget, was a $700, $750 million uncertainty of this potential clawback from the federal government with respect to education funding. And I think it kind of paralyzed us for a while during the session. And I hope we're through it. We think we're through it. And with getting through that, there might be opportunities for us to do more with some of these priorities.
That's a very finance answer. What happened in judiciary?
Well, I mean, this is anything we have to do that costs money, particularly the child care tax credit bill, which had my bill had a $1 million price tag on it. So it was focused just on working people that are in the middle class and want to be in the middle class. And so it's not a huge ask. I just think it's a matter of priorities. And we both agree on the need, but you know, it just wasn't considered a priority. And there are some uncertainties, but the last time I checked, we were hearing about a $1 billion surplus. And up until recently, the tax revenue estimates were beating them every quarter for as long as I can remember. So yes, there are variables, including this potential clawback, but I think the priorities are the priorities. And sadly, that's that.
Okay, let's shift to transparency and independence. From the legislative auditor's bill to the EBA bill, both were shrouded in lacks of transparency. One bill reduces the auditor's investigative independence and the other some journalistic independence. There also originally was a lot of confusion around what the bills actually do. How do bills like this serve the public?
I think one of the things that changed with respect to the legislative auditor was there was an individual who had been in the position for many years. And as that person announced their retirement, I think the legislative leadership looked for, do we just replace that one person or do we change the structure? And the decision was to evaluate maybe changing that structure as to how that's done. And so I think that's part of what triggered that change stepping back and maybe a reevaluation. Certainly we want our legislative auditors to be able to look throughout state government and try to find inefficiencies, try and find fraud. And so, I mean, that's my commitment to do that.
You do a great job on the West Virginia public television, which is, I think, part of your question. And I was against taking an independent entity and putting it into the government. I really think that is going to end up being something we regret, and I'll tell you why. You know, the governor, whoever the governor is going to be using that as a mouthpiece. I mean, it's part of his government now that he's in charge of, as opposed to an independent entity. I wonder whether people are going to be getting tax deductions for charitable contributions. I question that since it's a government entity. I really think that it takes away from transparency. It detracts from freedom of the press. I think it's a horrible move, and I'm against it, but, you know, it's going to happen.
That was Senate Minority Leader Mike Wolfel and Senator Mike Oliverio speaking with Brianna Heaney on the legislature today. To hear the rest of this discussion, visit our website, wvpublic.org. Something new we started this year on the legislature today is our Student Reporters Program, where we work with high school students who cover legislation from the State House and learn about the legislative process. In this inaugural year, our student reporters were Amira Mustafa and Ben Velo. News Director Eric Douglas sat down with them this week to hear about their experience during the past 60 days.
Simple question. What did you guys learn? What was this process for you when you got started as compared to where you are today?
Well, for starters, you know, outside of politics, this is our first time doing anything on camera or writing scripts or working with journalists. And the scriptwriting process and finding evidence and having claims that are unbiased, that was a big learning point for me, personally.
What I really learned is like the importance of the state government. Like in school, I didn't even learn what the 60-day legislature was. So whenever I was offered to work for the legislature today, I was a little unsure about what that would entail. But now I got to see like the importance of the state government and how at this point I might even vote for the governor before I would vote for our president.
Right.
Absolutely. The state government has a tremendous effect on our lives that probably the average person doesn't, because all you get is the national news mm-hmm. that talks about the presidential election, that sort of thing. I agree with you completely on that, guys. Ben, you talked about the script writing process. And I remember some of the early scripts. There were some things that's like, no, you can't say that. You have to have somebody else say that. Do you see yourself applying that in your school career moving forward? Or?
Well, most definitely. I think applying the journalism writing or the being able to write something that is informational and unbiased is a learning curve, because mm-hmm. you have to tell, you know, you want our perspectives as students, but you don't want our necessarily perspectives as people.
As people? Sure.
So, you know, you have to tell the world what needs to be heard, but you have to tell it in a way that is correct and unbiased. And for us, it was a lot of, you know, we had to talk about lobbying and bills that we personally want to fight against.
Sure.
Or bills that we want to fight for and push more, but you have to do it in a very put together way, or you have to be very
careful.
There's
a format. There's a process that we use. Let's talk about the legislative process a little bit. I know that was a learning curve for even people in this building. I promise mm-hmm. you, I'm not trying to embarrass you, but yeah, what was the biggest discovery for you as bills go through committee and then to the floor and then to the other chamber and all that?
I mean, it takes a lot of time. Yes. And the bills that you want to pass and you think that should be passing aren't getting the discussions because there are thousands of bills to go through. Mm-hmm. And you really get a sense of seeing what our politicians are. I mean, when you look at a politician's sort of IMDb or on the legislature.gov, you can see all the bills that they're sponsoring. You can see a little bit of what kind of got them into office and see what they're voting for, what they're pushing. And you can also kind of see as a collective what the senators are trying to focus on, which a lot of times is money and industry.
Sure.
I think my biggest surprise was the fact that it was only 60 days.
Yeah.
Again, I was constantly contrasting it with the federal government, and we always see 24/7 on the news what they're doing on this day, that week, what's the agenda. But for the state, weirdly, it was only 60 days, and I had a hard time wrapping my head around that.
As of a couple of days ago, last time I checked, there were nearly 2,600 bills introduced.
Yeah.
Only 50 at that point had passed so far. There have probably been a few more since then, but it's, there's... There's an awful lot going on, and this last week of the session will be even kind of crazier, to be honest.
And you know what else was really surprising about the whole process is, you know, we got to kind of dive into the role of lobbyism and what lobbyists do. They have a huge effect in the legislation that's passed, but they don't have to report anything in the state of West Virginia for another, what is it, three
months?
May 15th, even though it ends next week.
Right.
So That was a shock to me.
A lot of us will report on that exact thing come May. We'll report on, well, this lobbyist spent this amount of money, this something. But we will report on that. Be right. That's 2 months past.
Right.
We can't change anything. You know, oh, this lobbyist spent X amount of money on this particular member of legislature. When
it's too late.
Too late. Yeah. Right. What's the point? It's also interesting seeing, as students, the amount of bills that are about us or that are targeting minors when we don't have a say and we barely even hear about it.
Yeah.
So doing this has been really, it's refreshing to kind of be able to not only research it for ourselves, but also kind of put a voice out there that says, listen to this. This is what they're talking about without you there. I know at our school, our Gay Straight Alliance, just wrote letters to our local senators, Tom Tacubo and Eric Nelson Jr., mm-hmm. about how they are taking my friends' rights to healthcare away. Oh, but yeah. My friends don't even know that that's happening. And we don't have a representative for our demographic in there.
That was Ben Velo and Amira Mustafa speaking with Eric Douglas. Hear the rest of this interview on our website. And for our final story in this West Virginia week, amidst a flurry of vaccine legislation, Appalachia Health News reporter Emily Rice spoke with Dr. Susan Flesher, professor and chair of the Department of Pediatrics at Marshall University, for a conversation about vaccination laws in West Virginia.
Why is having a highly vaccinated population important to you as a physician?
It's very important to me because we see and have seen over the years the results of having a strong vaccine policy versus not having a strong vaccine policy. You may be aware there have been many measles outbreaks recently in other states. West Virginia has one of the best, strongest immunization policies in the United States. There are only about five states that have a policy as strong, and one of them is West Virginia.
How would allowing for a religious exemption to vaccination and not requiring students enrolled in private or virtual schools impact West Virginia's immunity?
Well, right now, the only exemptions that West Virginia allows are for medical reasons, and these need to be reviewed and approved. So that narrows it to evidence-based medicine, children that actually medically would not be able to take the vaccine for a medical condition. If the law that is being considered was passed, any parent would be able to request a religious exemption, and so it would actually be easier to get an exemption than it would be to go to the physician's office and get a vaccine, because all you have to do is just request the religious exemption. There does not need to be any review or approval for it. So it would leave the door wide open to children not being immunized.
What have some states faced after allowing these exemptions?
There are states that have had issues with cases, and California is a good example of one because they have had outbreaks, but they've worked to strengthen their immunization policies, and they have looked at West Virginia as a model.
Could you tell me about what kind of medical conditions keep people from getting vaccinated?
There are certain children that have a weakened immune system, children that have cancer and are receiving chemotherapy, which temporarily weakens their immune system, cannot receive the vaccines during certain periods. Some children are too young to be vaccinated. For instance, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is not given until 1 year of age. So what happens if you have a well-vaccinated population, you have what we call herd immunity, meaning that even though there might be someone with cancer that's not immunized, they don't have very high risk of getting the disease because most everybody around them is immunized.
Why would an immune compromised population need those who can get vaccinated to be vaccinated?
It's to protect them kind of secondarily. That's what we call herd immunity, because if you cannot be vaccinated, then you depend on the people around you to be vaccinated so that you're not exposed to the disease.
Could you talk to me about evidence-based medicine and why it's important to pay attention where our information is sourced from?
Now, when we look at any type of public health policy, it should be based upon evidence. It should be based on what we call evidence-based medicine. And in the case of immunizations, there is evidence and data that shows keeping our vulnerable populations healthy depends on maintaining school and childcare immunization policies that allow exemptions only for medical reasons.
That was Appalachia Health News reporter Emily Rice speaking with Dr. Susan Flesher about vaccination laws in West Virginia. Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health. That's it for West Virginia Week. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you back here next week. As always, you can see these stories and more at wvpublic.org. I'm Liz McCormick.